Hello, this is Chris with the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, April 7th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page, A Very Somber Day. Redbird community reflects on 10 years since fatal plane crash. From Normal. 10 years after a plane carrying 7 Bloomington Normal area men crashed, killing all on board, memories of the lost Redbird sports fans, coaches, and directors continue to soar in the minds of those who love them. A twin-engine Cessna 414A crashed just after midnight on April 7, 2015, about 2 miles east of Bloomington's Central Illinois Regional Airport. Over 2 years later, the Pentagraph reported the National Transportation Safety Board found the crash was probably caused by the pilot's loss of control and a subsequent stall or spin, among other factors. Carried on the Cessna's final flight were 2 leaders of Illinois State University athletics and 5 other Redbird supporters and area businessmen. The crash victims, who became known as the Redbird 7, were Scott Bittner, 42, of Eureka Locker Company, Andy Butler, 40, national accountant manager at Sprint Nextel, Tom Hilleman, 51, pilot and owner of Hilleman Aviation, Jason Jones, 45, vice president and certified financial planner at Sicord Jones Wealth Management Group, Aaron Letch, 37, deputy director of athletics at ISU, Terry Strandlow, 64, Pub 2 owner, and finally Tori Ward, 36, associate head coach of men's basketball at ISU. The university's athletic department will hold a public Redbird remembrance at 10 a.m. today at the Memorial for the Crash Victims, located just north of the arena on campus. Director of Athletics Emeritus Larry Lyons and current University Athletic Director Jerry Beggs will speak, with staff, students, and athletes also in attendance. In an interview late last month, Mike Williams, Associate Director of Athletics, said it's eerie thinking back to his last conversation with Letch, who was his direct supervisor. He said Letch spoke at a School of Communication class for COM week before getting on his departure flight. "Have fun, be safe," he recounted as his final words to Letch. Janice Ward, Tori Ward's mother, said her friends were all endeared by Tori and that they all unofficially adopted him as their own. She said her son was once a teenager who'd tossed his socks in the wrong places at home, yet grew up to be a focused role model and mentor. "He was going to be an advocate for his players, wherever they were," she said. She added that John Jones, a former men's basketball player at ISU, also spoke of Tori's coaching. Lindsay Jones, a Bloomington native who now lives in the Kansas City, Missouri area, said her late husband, Jason Jones, was adored and beloved. "I think all of the families of crash victims would absolutely say life was a lot better and brighter when they were here." Dan Mueller, former men's basketball head coach, broke down in tears when accepting the 2017 Missouri Valley Conference Coach of the Year award, noting Letch should have been at the table with him. "When I think about what our team has been through, the journey has been fun, but we know it's not fair. But that's okay. Life is not fair. It's not fair those men died in that plane crash, and not fair those 13 kids lost their fathers," Mueller said during that 2017 event. Janice Ward, of Birmingham, Alabama, said her family made it to as many games as they could that Tori coached. She said that when the Redbirds faced off with the University of Alabama at Birmingham in a December 7, 2014 game, her son stayed behind for a big family dinner after his team went back to Normal. "It was the last time most of his family saw him alive." The plane crash followed exactly 4 months later. "Nobody knows what the next day holds," Ward said. She added her family miss everything about Tori Ward every day. "During March Madness is a especially hard time of the year," Williams said. The 7 men had been on their way back from an NCAA tournament championship game in Indianapolis when their plane crashed. The basketball team was hit really hard. To Williams, losing his boss was devastating. Williams said he knew Letch while he was in graduate school, and Letch was working for the university. When Larry Lyons took over as athletic director, Letch became deputy athletic director in 2013. There's no doubt in my mind that he would have been a future athletic director at ISU, Williams said of Letch. Williams, who stepped up to an assistant athletic director position in 2012, said NCAA tournaments offer programs like clinics and conventions for coaches to get together. While in Indianapolis, the Redbird Seven had met with ISU alumni basketball players. It's also a chance for younger coaches to meet, mix, and mingle and get their name out there. After the plane crash and the ensuing whirlwind of media inquiries and working with law enforcement and other investigators, the emotional impact finally landed on Williams. I don't think that it really hit me hard until Aaron's funeral, Williams said. I broke down. Even after 10 years, he said the loss still hurts, and he can only imagine how the victims' families feel. It's a very somber day, typically, but I also like to remember the good times and the positive impacts that they made not only on the athletic department, but on the communities and reaching out to communities. Torrey Ward left behind three children. His youngest daughter was born just weeks after his death. His middle child, Torrey Nicholas Ward, will graduate from high school in a few months and plans to play football for Samford University in Alabama, said Grandma Janice Ward. Torrey Ward's oldest child, Tamia, is in her first year of medical school. Joan's son, Jack, just graduated from high school and will play baseball for the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Mom Lindsay Jones added her daughter Kate plays on the golf team as a high school junior. Jones said she and Jason also knew Scott Bittner very well and that, like her husband, he was a good man to his core. Williams said college students who spent time at the Strollo's pub knew he was the greatest dude in the world and a good friend to ISU coaches. All of the guys have missed so much, Jones said of all the crash victims. There are so many people who loved them and respected them. There's a huge hole in all of our lives. We're okay, we're figuring it out, but life was better when they were here. When doing things with her children, Lindsay Jones said she tries to channel her inner Jason Jones voice and think what he would do. Williams said Letch kept level-headed, never got too high or too down. Letch was always there to help when something was going on. In a development role, Letch was a great fundraiser. That's why these people were on there on the flight, because they were all friends of Aaron's, and they were all people that he was trying to bring into the fold of the Redbird family. He was a people person and utmost family man, husband and dad. Lindsay Jones said one way the families continue to honor the men they lost is through an initiative called Project 7, which encourages people to commit to acts of kindness. All seven families, we agree the world just needs more kindness. We should be doing acts of kindness every day, but on April 7th, it just seems like the time to remind people. Janice Ward said sometimes that means random acts of charity, like her paying for seven orders behind her in a coffee shop drive-thru. She said Project 7 has also prepared snack bags for families waiting at hospitals and donated shoes to school children. Jones and Ward each said they will visit the Bloomington Normal area on the 10th anniversary of the crash to attend today's remembrance ceremony. The main memorial site is adorned with seven stone fountains representing each life lost in the crash. Following the crash, Williams noted many moments of silence were observed, and every sports team member wore a Redbird 7 logo on their sporting gear through the 2015-16 school year. Other memorials honor the Redbird 7 across campus. They include the Aaron Letch Clubhouse in the upper floors of Hancock Stadium and a suite honoring Andy Butler at CEFCU Arena. A large memorial plaque is also installed along the inner concourse of the arena. Williams said that there was an unbelievable rally of support from the community after the crash. He said there were blood drives, food drives, and memorial donations. We needed it because we were all hurting too. Jones said she sees a lot of red-colored birds flying around her backyard this time of year. She even saw one fluttering around during the March 31st interview with the Pentagraph. My daughter and I were sitting outside yesterday, and one just landed and kept staring at me, she continued. I know that happens to my parents and Jason's parents, too, so we think he's still keeping an eye on us. Also on the front page, experts prep to survive tornado. Radio, shelter, clothes, all can improve odds. From Atlanta. With new innovations and technology, scientists have learned from major tornado outbreaks over the years how to improve safety guidance. During tornado season, forecasters try to get the word out about staying safe during a storm, but also planning for it ahead of time. Tornado seasons typically begin at different times in different parts of the United States. In what has historically been known as Tornado Alley, a designation that typically includes Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, the peak of tornado season is May through early June. But the season starts earlier in what's often called Dixie Alley, made up of southern states such as Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. The idea of a tornado alley can be misleading since tornadoes have been reported in all 50 states. About 1,200 tornadoes strike the U.S. every year, and each year violent twisters happen outside these traditional alleys of tornado outbreaks, according to the National Severe Storms Laboratory. Recent twisters have been struck in places unaccustomed to them, such as one near Los Angeles in 2023 that tore apart rooftops and injured one person. When a tornado takes aim at your house and the sirens are sounding, the dogs are barking and the children are screaming, there are some last-minute precautions that could save the lives of you and your loved ones. Experts also recommend a few simple steps to prepare well before the twister is on your doorstep. Here's a look at some tornado safety tips. First, how do I get emergency updates? Weather radio, specialized receivers that get alerts and can sound an alarm is in an emergency are something that every home and business should have, said Rick Smith, the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Norman, Oklahoma. It does feel like old-school technology, but they are life-saving devices. Radios can be particularly valuable in the South, where many tornadoes strike at night when people are sleeping. This can wake you up in the middle of the night with the alarm. The National Weather Service encourages people to have multiple ways of being warned, which can include weather radios, a cell phone app, or other method in case power is lost. Redundancy is key. Next, where should I take shelter? The ideal places to take shelter are enclosed, underground shelters in basements, or a safe room above ground that's designated to withstand tornadic winds. But many people don't have that option. In Oklahoma, for example, the clay soil makes building basements expensive, so lots of homes don't have them. If you have to be above ground in a tornado, your goal is to put as many walls and barriers between you and the outside as you possibly can. Smith recommends using mattresses, couch cushions, or other sturdy items to protect yourself from deadly flying or falling debris. Bicycle or sports helmets can provide crucial head protection. It's important that they are stored in a convenient place so they can be retrieved quickly when you have only minutes or seconds before the storm strikes. A car seat can help protect a small child, Smith says, and can be brought inside ahead of time. How can I keep my home safe? Recent research has shown that closing your home's garage door and all interior doors could ease the high winds inside somewhat by compartmentalizing them, according to Smith. Doing so is recommended during thunderstorms and tornadoes by the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. That's the opposite of a commonly held misconception. There's still a chunk of people out there who think they're supposed to open the windows and doors to equalize the pressure. It's also important to prepare for the tornado's aftermath, when you might emerge from a home or shelter to find downed trees and power lines and shredded buildings. Dress for disaster, such as wearing long pants and sturdy shoes, to make it easier to safely navigate treacherous terrain. An emergency kit of essentials like drinking water and non-perishable food items is also a good idea. With the threat of strong tornadoes in the forecast this week for Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, and other states, forecasters are urging people to have emergency supplies, know where their safe places are, and have a family communication plan. And finally, what should I do if I'm driving? Don't look to Hollywood for sound tornado safety practices. The recent Hollywood film Twister shows the characters sprinting toward a highway underpass as a tornado approaches. If you're in a car or truck, you really don't have a lot of good options at that point. Try not to get caught in that situation. The best thing to do is to get off the road and try to find a building. If there's nowhere to go, there are no guaranteed safe options. When it comes to ditches, overpasses, or staying inside a car, people have survived doing all of those things. People have died doing all of those things. I've seen cars rolled up into unrecognizable balls of metal. Also on the front page, funding loss devastates ag research. Aaron McGuire spent years cultivating fruits and vegetables like onions, peppers, and tomatoes as a scientist and later director of a lab at the University of California, Davis. She collaborated with hundreds of people to breed drought-resistant varieties, develop new ways to cool fresh produce, and find ways to make more money for small farmers at home and overseas. Then the funding stopped. Her lab, and by extension many of its overseas partners, were backed financially by the United States Agency for International Development, which Trump's administration has been dismantling. Just before it was time to collect data that was 2 years in the making, her team received a stop work order. She had to lay off her whole team. Soon, she was laid off too. "It's really just been devastating," she said. "I don't know how you come back from this." The U.S. needs more publicly funded research and development on agriculture to offset the effects of climate change. According to a recent paper in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, instead, the U.S. invested less. U.S. Department of Agriculture data shows that as of 2019, the U.S. spent about a third less on agricultural research than its peak in 2002, a difference of about $2 billion. Recent freezes for funding for research on climate change and international development only added to the drop. It's a serious issue for farmers who depend on new innovations to keep their businesses afloat, the next generation of scientists, and eventually consumers who buy food. If scientists have reliable backing, they can keep improving crop varieties to better withstand perilous weather conditions like droughts or floods, find new uses for existing crop species, figure out how to protect workers, develop new technology to aid in planting and harvesting, or create more effective ways to fight pests. They also can investigate agriculture's potential role in fighting climate change. "This is terrible news for the U.S. agricultural sector," said Cornell Associate Professor Ariel Boiba, the lead author of the paper. "As the Trump administration pauses and shutters research programs funded by the Environmental Protection Agency, USDA, and other agencies, Boiba and other experts saw field trials stopped, postdoctoral positions eliminated, and a gap forming between the reality of climate change and the tools farmers have to deal with it." The EPA declined to comment, and the USDA and USAID did not respond to Associated Press queries. Bueba and his team qualified overall U.S. agricultural productivity, estimated how much it would be slowed by climate change in coming years, and calculated how much money would need to be invested in research and development to counteract that slowdown. Think of it like riding a bike into a headwind. To maintain the same speed, you have to pedal harder. In this case, R&D can be that extra push. Some countries are heading in that direction. China spends almost twice as much as the U.S. on agricultural research and increased its research investments by 5 times since the year 2000, said Goswami, a scientist with the Food and Environmental Team at the Union of Concerned Scientists, wrote in an email. U.S. spending cutbacks also shuttered agricultural research across almost all of the Feed the Future Innovation Labs, of which McGuire was one. Those 17 labs across 13 universities focused on food security, technical agriculture research, policy, and various aspects of climate change. The stop work orders at those labs not only disappointed researchers, but made much of their work useless. There are many, many millions of dollars of expenditure that will generate nothing now because the work couldn't be finished, said David Tershley, a professor who was directing another one of those programs, the Innovation Lab for Food Security Policy Research, Capacity and Influence at Michigan State University since 2019. Some researchers hope other sources of funding can fill the gap. That's where private sector could really step up, said Swati Hedge, a scientist in the Food, Land, and Water Program at the World Resources Institute. From an agricultural point of view, climate change is really scary, with larger and larger regions exposed to temperatures above healthy growing conditions for many crops, said Bill Anderson, CEO of Bayer, a multinational biotechnology and pharmaceutical company that invested nearly $3 billion in agricultural research and development last year. However, private companies have their own constraints on R&D investment, and he said Bayer can invest as much as it would like in that area. I don't think that private industry can replicate how federal funding typically supports early stage speculative science because the economics don't really work. He added that industry tends to be better suited to back ideas that already have been validated. Goswami also expressed concerns that private research funding isn't as trackable and transparent as public funding. Others said even sizable investments from companies don't give anywhere near enough money to match government funding. The full impact may not be apparent for many years, and the damage won't easily be repaired. Experts think it will be a blow in other countries where climate change is already decimating yields, driving hunger and conflict. I really worry that if we don't really look at the global food situation, we will have a disaster. And from Champaign, U of I launches transfer effort. The University of Illinois system announced last week the launch of a pilot program aimed at increasing the number of students transferring from community colleges to four-year universities. The program's objective is to lower barriers and provide targeted career advising to low-income and first-generation college students wanting to transfer to four-year schools. While 81% of community college students say getting a bachelor's degree is their goal, only 31% of students transfer to a four-year institution. This program aims to increase that number. In collaboration with 1 Million Degrees, a Chicago-based nonprofit supporting community college students, the program will unlock opportunities that will fuel our state's workforce and economic future, University of Illinois System President Tim Killeen said in a news release. We are highly motivated to build on the momentum that we have created with Illinois' community colleges, expanding opportunities for students to not only access higher education, but to thrive in rewarding careers. The pilot will begin by serving 240 students from select community colleges. Students will be provided with academic and career support through their transfer to the University of Illinois campuses in Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield. The first cohort of students will begin in spring 2026, and the second will begin in the spring of 2027. The university system is working to select participating community colleges. Researchers have found that transferring from community colleges to four-year universities is one of the most powerful tools to improve opportunities, especially for first-generation and low-income students. Josh Hohen, interim CEO of 1 Million Degrees, said in a news release, "We cannot allow these pathways to become bridges to nowhere for students taking the risk to transfer. This is about ensuring that when students bet big on themselves by pursuing a college degree, they see a powerful labor market return that will dramatically increase their career and earning potential. To ensure a smooth transition into four-year institutions, 1 Million Degrees will provide students with support, including academic coaching, financial assistance, and career services. The U of I system will assess the pilot over the next 4 years and may consider expanding it beyond the initial participating community colleges to help more students," according to the news release. And from Germany, Buchenwald Liberation recalled with a warning from Vienna. Germany marked the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazis' Buchenwald concentration camp on Sunday, as one of the country's former presidents warned against radicalization and a worldwide shift to the right. The governor of the state of Thuringia, Mario Voigt, and former German President Christian Wolff spoke at a ceremony in the city of Weimar near Buchenwald, attended by scores of people, including several Holocaust survivors from across Europe. Voigt, whose state includes Buchenwald, called it a place of systemic dehumanization and said that everything that happened at the death camp was designed to break the human spirit and its dignity. Buchenwald concentration camp was established in 1937, and more than 56,000 of the 280,000 inmates held at Buchenwald and its satellite camps were killed by the Nazis or died as a result of hunger, illness, or medical experiments before the camp's liberation on April 11, 1945. Voigt also said that the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel showed that the intention to exterminate Jews is not a thing of the past. He was referring to the attack by the Palestinian militant group that left some 1,200 people dead and 251 taken hostage, sparking the war between Israel and Hamas. The Israeli retaliation offensive in the Gaza Strip has killed at least 50,000 Palestinians and wounded 115,000, according to Gaza's health ministry. In the run-up to the memorial event, Israeli officials objected to a planned commemoration speech by the philosopher and grandson of a Holocaust survivor and a known critic of the Israeli government and its actions in Gaza. This prompted organizers to withdraw the invitation. Some 6 million European Jews were killed by the Nazis during the Holocaust. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, April 7th. Please stay tuned.
217-586-2611. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pentagraph of Friday, April 4th, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you soon.